Carl Koppelman was an accountant by both education and trade. However, through an unfortunate series of events, he found himself with a lot of time on his hands. What did he do with it? He became one of the foremost forensic artists in the United States, changing more lives than he ever could have imagined. You hear his story today. I'm Ed Densel, and this is Unfound. As all of you know, I like to switch things up once in a while on Unfound. It's not always about cases on this program. I guess some examples of that might be having Tad DeBias on to talk about no body cases. I had my friend Megan Good on the program to talk about her site charlieproject.org and how she became interested in missing persons cases. You also remember Gary Jenkins, a good guy who hosts the Gangland Wire podcast. He came on to talk about mafia disappearances. I do this because I want to be able to give the listeners a total three-dimensional view of the missing persons community in the United States. And to me, that means featuring people who are working behind the scenes, who haven't lost anybody, have not lost a brother, a sister, a son or daughter, or a parent, but just have gotten into it because it is their passion. They want to change people's lives. Today is one of those episodes. Also, anytime I have a chance to feature a regular person out there who has solved cases, I'm going to do it. You know I have a firm belief that cases can be solved by just regular people. Teachers, engineers, truck drivers. With the internet these days, the ability to network and crowdsource, regular people can do this. And so for today's episode, we have Carl Koppelman. At one point, he was just a mild-mannered accountant who is now getting calls at 4 a.m. to do interviews with big media companies because of the way he's affected people's lives. To me, this is way more impressive than winning American Idol or The Price is Right or whatever else. All that is about money and fame, stuff that is fleeting in life. Whereas Carl is dealing in real life issues of death, murder, rape, the worst that the earth has to offer, and he is getting real answers for families. How does he do that? Using his artistic abilities, he brings unidentified dead people back to life. And he's so good at it that some of his pictures have resulted in cases being solved. You'll hear my in-depth interview with him in just a few minutes. But first, the unfound housekeeping items. You can find this podcast on Twitter, at Unfound Podcast. In fact, you'll be noticing some changes there starting this week. You can email the program, unfoundpodcast@gmail.com. You can find the program on Podomatic and iTunes. And I would appreciate it if you think the show deserves it. Please give it a 5-star review at iTunes. You can find this program on Facebook. It's the Unfound Discussion Group. It's a private group right now. And come join the conversation, although I will tell you that we will be starting a public Facebook page very shortly. And please tell your friends and family about the program and mention the show if you frequent places like Web Sleuths, Reddit, the page Podcasts We Listen To on Facebook, and any other true crime forums and websites. And now, Unfound News. Several changes are coming to the program, although I can assure you, the format of the program is not changing. You're going to notice changes on my Twitter feed. You're going to notice that an additional Facebook page is going to be created. It's going to be a public page. The private discussion group will continue, and I hope it continues to get members week after week as it's been doing. However, we're going to have a new Instagram account, and we're going to have a new logo. We're going to start from scratch with it. It's going to be something that I can copyright. Also, I'm in the process of covering a case that has to do with a person other than an American citizen who disappeared in another country. That'll be a first for Unfound. In fact, this case is the most well-known disappearance case in this particular country. I have a listener who is helping me with all of this, and I can't thank her enough. Finally, in a few weeks, I'm also going to get to meet the parent of a missing person for the first time. The meeting will happen right here in Florida, and it's a case where the authorities have dismissed the disappearance as an accident. Needless to say, the parents and myself aren't so sure. Before we get into the interview for this episode, I need to really thank Kathy Turkanian. If the name sounds familiar, she was a guest on this program back in November 2016, where she talked about the disappearance of her biological daughter, Alexis, also known as Andrea. She disappeared in 1989. Kathy knows Carl very well, and she put me in contact with him. Kathy, I can't thank you enough. I now present to you my interview with Carl Koppelman. I'm so happy to have on this episode of Unfound the guy who draws dead people, Carl Koppelman. Carl, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm glad to be on your show.
Carl, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and who you were and then how you eventually all got into this artistic ability and what you're doing to help solve missing persons cases. How did that all happen?
Okay, well, my career, since I got out of college in the early 90s, I studied accounting, and I'm a CPA, so I was working as an accountant since the early 90s. I worked at the L.A. County Municipal Court for 5 years, and then I went to Princess Cruises for 5 years. I worked at Disney for about a year and a half, mm-hmm. and when I was laid off at Disney, that was during the financial crisis, and there weren't a whole lot of jobs at the time, and it happened that my mother was, her condition was becoming very frail, and she's 94 years old now, but this was back in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
She needed somebody around the house full time to take care of her, and the only other option was to put her in assisted living, and we weren't going to do that.
Right.
So my siblings and I, we all agreed that I'll just become the full time caretaker. So that left me at home with quite a bit of spare time.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a bit of time that she's either sleeping or doesn't need me at the, at that particular moment. So
yeah.
I'm in front of my computer quite a bit. And this was back in August of 2009.
Well, do you have an artistic background? You're an accountant. You're officially an accountant. That was your job. I guess that's what you went to school for. But where does this artistic background come from?
Well, I've always had facial drawing skills. This goes back to when I was in high school. I'd sit in high school, and if there was a boring lecture from, one of the high school teachers,
mm-hmm.
I'd be sitting in the class, drawing caricatures of the students, drawing caricatures of the teachers. I mean, I just used to like to doodle and draw, and I had a very good aptitude for drawing faces.
Mm-hmm.
It was never anything that I had, intended to do professionally.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually became an accountant, but and most of my adult life I didn't do any drawing at all. But as I got into this this new world of missing and unidentified, mm-hmm. I found that my facial drawing skills had quite a good applicability to this topic.
Did they come back pretty quick? You say you didn't draw for a long time once again because you were an accountant. Did those abilities and skills come back to you pretty quick, or how is that?
Well,
is it like riding a bike or not?
Yeah, I guess in some sense, but the real challenge was trying to learn how to use the software.
Oh, okay.
Everything I was doing was on computers. So when I started, I was on Web Sleuth,
mm-hmm.
and I never got to that part, but I was on Web Sleuth, and I was looking at this one case. It involved a guy who had gone into an abandoned hotel in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. It was a man who was wearing a Philadelphia Eagles jersey. He went in there to scavenge, metal and, scrap metal.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got in there, and he stepped on something, cut his foot, and bled to death. And so they found this man's body inside this abandoned hotel. And there was a coroner's photo of him. His, face, he wasn't decomposed at all. It was just, a man who was, his mouth was open a little bit. But otherwise, it was a, pretty, just looked like a man sleeping.
Okay.
And so I took the photo and drew eyes in there. And first of all, I had looked at the forensic drawing that they had official forensic drawing of this guy, and it didn't look anything like him.
Mm.
I was looking at that and thinking, well, gosh, you've got this coroner photo and you got this drawing and they don't look like the same person. So I decided, okay, I have drawing skills. Let's see if I can pull this up on Corel Photo Paint and alter it and make it look like a living person. And so I put eyes on him, and I straightened out his mouth using, kind of cutting and pasting in the image, and straightened his mouth out and smoothed things out a little bit and put a Philadelphia Eagles jersey on him.
Mm-hmm.
And, and just put it up there on Web Sleuth, and, it was just like, okay, how about this? This looks much better than, than the official police drawing that they'd put out. And I didn't really think much of it until a few days later. There was a woman who ran a website for Pennsylvania missing persons. She has a website that's dedicated to Pennsylvania missing persons, and she said, I like that drawing you did. Can I put it on my site? And I said, yeah, sure.
Wow. And then I bet you must have been really surprised. You must have been really surprised by that, right? So quickly?
Well, yeah, I was kind of surprised. It's like, oh, okay, this, people like what I'm doing. And then a couple of days later, I noticed that she was a volunteer for Doe Network. And so she had put it on Doe Network as well. So I thought,
this is getting big.
Cool, using my drawings on Doe Network. So,
yeah, it's getting big.
And, when I first initially started doing this, I didn't really have a good handle on using the software. I didn't, I hadn't used Corel Photo Paint that much, so I didn't, have any techniques and all that developed.
Right.
And so, so over the years, as I kept doing these, well, first of all, Doe Network started asking me to do additional ones.
Hmm.
And as I said, the first few were kind of crude, and they didn't, I didn't have all the tools and techniques yet developed, so, they weren't that good at first. But as I kept doing these, more and more, I developed techniques and started. Mm-hmm. They started getting better. Mm-hmm. The quality of the images.
So you had an interest in missing persons cases and unidentified bodies before you got into this, was that something interest you always had as well?
Going back to, the 2009, I've always had a kind of an interest in unsolved mysteries and, true crime. And, there's various stories, over the years that it kind of caught my attention and that I paid attention, that I followed these, crime stories, whether it be, Ted Bundy, or whether it be, all these various crime stories that have been on the news over the years. Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris were a couple of serial murderers who operated right in my neighborhood, or, in the adjacent cities to where I live. So I followed those cases. And, so when 2009, when I was, sitting at home and having to care for my mother.
Yeah.
This J.C. Dugard story came up.
Oh, okay.
Sure. I happen to remember it was the day Ted Kennedy passed away.
Oh.
I was just on the internet just reading the news about Ted Kennedy's death, and a story right there on the Huffington Post was a girl missing 18 years since she was 11 years old walks into a probation office and you know, along with her captors. And, you know, she's now 29 years old, and I thought, wow, this is amazing. And I started following that story, and at the time, they didn't have any photos of J.C. In the current day. They were keeping that under wraps. They didn't want anybody to know what she looked like now. And so I was kind of scrambling all over the internet trying to find photos. I was very curious what she looked like. And I was going through all these different stories about, you know, about the initial kidnapping and seeing, you know, news press, you know, press events with her mother on the, you know, standing in front of the El Dorado County Sheriff's Office with this big oversized teddy bear in her arms and crying her eyes out and, you know, saying, please, you know, let my daughter go home. And I mean, it was, it very touched me quite.
Yeah, but quite a bit. I remember that too. Yeah.
It had quite an effect on me. And so,
sure.
You know, and the thought that 18 years later, this woman could be sitting in her office at her job and get a telephone call from the El Dorado County Sheriff saying, oh, JC's sitting here with me. You want to talk to her?
That's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. It's crazy amazing. Yes.
I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to see, you know, her reaction that, you know, this woman's been suffering for 18 years and then all of a sudden she gets this phone call and, you know, here she is. You can talk to her again. So,
she was gone for all that time. Now that you draw these people, did they do drawings of JC while she was gone?
Well, yeah, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children did age progression of her. And, you know, people can see for themselves whether they, you know, did a good job.
What do you think? How do you think that they did over those years of drawing?
It was reasonably close. I'm not going to be critical of it, but, you know.
Okay.
You know, as I was following this story, that's when I came across Web Sleuth, because as for Googling the name J.C. Dugard, there was a lot of discussion of her case over the years, long before she was found alive, they were discussing her case on Web Sleuth. And there was this story about a girl, they called her Maricopa Jane Doe. This was a 1999 case of a young girl, teenage girl, going down the highway near the Phoenix area, jumped out of the car or either fell out of the car or something, but she was going highway speed like 70 miles an hour and exited the vehicle at 70 miles an hour and was killed on the highway.
Oh, no.
And 10 years, they didn't know who she was. She was a Jane Doe for nearly a decade. And the Web Sleuth people were discussing J.C. Dugard as a possible identity of this Jane Doe. Of course, we know now it wasn't. They eventually did find out who she was because her brother, the dead girl's brother, found the discussion on Web Sleuth and said, that might be my sister. And so, you know, I was amazed that you had thousands of people following this story and trying to figure out who this girl was.
Yeah.
As it turned out, the girl's name was Tawny Lee Mazzoni. She was 16 years old when she died. And, they eventually did figure out who she was,
but I
was very intrigued at the idea that people could sit there in front of their computers and solve missing persons cases.
Yeah,
and there were a lot of resources dedicated to that effort. Now you have No Network, you have NamUs, you have several missing persons sites.
Yeah.
And, you know, people from all walks of life can sit in front of their computer and, you know, and brainstorm these things. It's really amazing. And
so
since then, that's kind of been, you know, there were a few other cases as well that had been solved by Web Sleuth members or by people in the internet community.
Right.
And I thought, okay, you know, this is, over the years, I've gotten more and more involved in it. And
yeah, you've used not just your interests, but these inherent talents you have. You've combined them, which not a lot of people have done. It makes yourself very unique, and you've been, you know, what I would say, you know, very successful at this. What is your process? Like, when you get a picture, what do you do first? How do you analyze it as an artist? If you can explain it to all of us people who do stick figures.
I mean, for a lot of these cases, there are postmortem photos available, and you really don't want to put those postmortem photos out there on your Facebook page.
No.
People won't want to share them. They're, you know, some of them are fairly disturbing. So, I'm just aware of all the various photos that are out there, and I just decide, okay, I want to do this one, I want to do that one. There's no real process. I'm usually more interested in the ones involving young people, but you know, I do people of all ages or all races or all backgrounds. I have a few of people who seem to be homeless, and but my general focus is if there's a postmortem photo available of a young person, I'm more interested in that just because if you're young, you generally have family that's looking
for
you.
Sure.
That's been my maybe bias, I guess you could say. But
do you, looking at these photos, does it ever get any easier for you? Because you get to see photos probably a lot of us, regular people, I guess, don't get to see. Do you ever get used to seeing some of those? Like you said, some of them can be pretty, pretty bad.
Yeah, some of them are pretty bad. And some of them are just look like the person's asleep. Others where you have decomposition, they can be quite disturbing.
I just wonder, I can't imagine, I know that... you're being helpful. You're using your skills. Obviously, you've been successful. And I'm imagining that seeing those pictures has to be the toughest part.
But I've learned with the techniques I've learned. I think I've done a reasonably good job of, trying to present them as they might look, before they died. So,
do you start on the eyes first, or do you start on the hair? Where do you usually start with a particular picture? Does it depend?
I guess it all depends. I probably start with the eyes first. I part of my process, I use photos of living people because generally when when you have a deceased face, a lifeless face, the muscles are all flattened and relaxed. There's no smile lines. The face sags. Often, so, and the skin tone and muscle tone is, not as it would be when they were alive. So, you have to use I use photos of living people and kind of overlay them and create a transparency of the living photo, and then it kind of has the effect of bringing out the life in the face while leaving all the structural lines intact. So. I mean, it's a little difficult to explain, without showing
it's
on
tough,
the screen,
right?
But,
I understand.
But yeah, I use these photos of living people, and then you end up with just having to fine tune it by drawing in,
There's certainly
a shape of their facial structure.
There's certain I guess maybe what you're saying is there's certain a little bit of artistic interpretation that goes into it.
Exactly.
You just kind of have to go with your gut on certain things sometimes.
Yeah, but the photo of the living person, when you're done, if you've done it right, the photo doesn't look like the living person that you used to create the life, to put the life back into the image, but... it should retain all the structural integrity of the original postmortem photo, but the life and muscle tone and skin tone and all that stuff comes through from the photo of the living person.
Where do you get the photo of the living person from?
Oh, I get them from all over the internet. If I'm browsing the internet and I find a good, real clear photo of anybody, has a real good high resolution photo of somebody, I'll save it in a directory, and I probably have several hundred photos of just faces in a directory on my computer that I can go to You know, if I have a post-mortem photo of somebody, I'll, you know, try to find another photo of somebody the same race and same approximate age. And it doesn't, they don't have to necessarily look that much like the deceased person, because, you know, the character of the face doesn't come through when you do this. It's just the, you know, the vitality and skin tone and muscle tone that comes through.
But, are you trying to match up like the bone structure of the unidentified person with a living person on the internet? Is that kind of the pairing that you're trying to find, or what's the criteria?
Just basically the same age, race, and gender.
Okay.
It's you know, it's not, as I said, if I've done it right, you won't look like the person whose photo I used, the living person.
Yeah, that's not. Yeah, that wouldn't be helpful, right?
You know,
right.
Right. So, you know, it's a matter of just you know, if you take that living person and show their photo at, you know, 95% transparency and overlay it over the dead person, then you get the vitality from the living person without it looking like the living person. Mm-hmm. So that's basically it in a nutshell. But,
okay. What's the time frame?
You know, I mean, over the years.
Okay. Please continue, please.
Oh, okay. No, that's fine. You said what's the time frame?
Yeah, like from the first time you did that first picture, how long did that take? And now these days, of course, now that you've done many of them, how has that changed? Has your technique changed since you started?
Well, I've learned to do things in layers and to save my progress. So, you know, if I go down a path and decide I've screwed up, I can go back to a previous step in the process and, you know, without, you know, having to redo the thing entirely. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can do things in layers. I'll do their hair, one layer for their hair, one layer for their clothing, one layer for, you know, say the glasses or whatever. I'll put those on in Corel Photo Paint, as, you know, does things in objects, you know, using their term. Everything's an object. So you do 20 or 30 different layers over one over the other, and it, I've learned to do things that way, and that's very helpful. So, you know, it can take anywhere from, you know, a couple of hours, you know, or to a couple of days, depending on, you know, what I'm starting with. I've also started doing skeletal reconstructions too, so it's not just, you know, freshly dead bodies. I've been taking skulls, and as a matter of fact, just yesterday, I completed an image. It was a man found in a tent up in Pend Oreille County in Washington. He was apparently living in the tent, and the local coroner's office asked me to do a reconstruction of the skull they had. And so I was just completing that, and so I'm fairly happy with what I've come up with. That
has to be probably a whole different level of difficulty compared to... Oh, did you find that to be a little more difficult?
Again, you're using photos of living people, but you still have to follow the integrity of the structural integrity from the skull. You can't just drop a photo of a living person and stretch their features into position and leave it at that. You still have to, you know, go point by point on all the points on the skull, and you have to have a little bit of a knowledge of anatomy and musculature. And you still have to do quite a bit of freehand drawing as well. So it's a little more work. There's a lot more work actually for a skull, but this one I did, I was able to complete within about a day or two. So
okay,
you know, and it's helpful to know if there was hair left with the, you know, at the scene, and clothing left with the scene. That's always helpful too. Then much better than if they just find a skull somewhere with no hair, no clothing, or,
Now sometimes when you get, like, for example, this one, it's a skull, you can't just eyeball it and know if it's a white person or African.
Oh, yeah, you can.
Okay.
Yeah,
can you
tell from a skull? Yeah, you can tell from a skull the age, gender, and race. It's you know, different races have very distinctive features, and you know, like Caucasians tend to have more raised nose, or you know, their nose project more. Blacks tend to have a projected upper maxilla. Certain features that are typical of certain races.
See, I see as a layman, and
I've read up on that. You can look at I can look at a skull and pretty instant. I can tell you whether it's male or female pretty quickly, and I can tell you likely what race the person was.
Wow, and I know I couldn't do that. I don't think I could do that.
If you look a little closer at it, you can tell probably their approximate age because the fusion of the cranial sutures. You know, the skull is made up of different plates.
Yes.
On the
it's not all one solid
all
piece.
Fused together.
Yeah, yeah.
No, they're all fused together.
Fused together.
And as a person ages, those sutures disappear. So, you know, if you find a skull with all the with the cranial sutures all fused together and obliterated, then you can assume the person is much older.
A lot older.
If they don't have wisdom teeth, or if their wisdom teeth haven't come out, you know, you can presume they're a certain age range, or you know, there are various features you can look at to pinpoint, you know, a pretty close reasonable age range.
That's fascinating. Now I know that you pick some of these people out on your own, but if the police come to you and said, can you help us out with this?
Well, in the case of Spokane, Washington, they've taken notice. Well, there was one case that I had done on my own of a woman in Spokane who had, she'd been found in the river, and she was decapitated and her hands and feet were cut off. But they found her body in the river in 1984. And then 14 years later, in 1998, they found her skull in a field, in a field that had been used as a dumping ground, so or the garbage dump, I should say. And so, so I had a photo of this skull that they had put on Namus, and I thought, oh, this is an interesting case. Let me see. It was interesting, particularly because this woman obviously had very unique facial characteristics. She had a very pointed chin. She had, you could tell from her teeth were there were. Several teeth missing that had fallen out, but you could see from where the sockets were that she had gap teeth. She had a very, very pronounced underbite. So, you know, there were some very interesting facial characteristics.
Unique, sure.
That I decided, okay, let me see if I can, you know, present what this woman looked like in life, and I created this image. And as it turned out, there's a woman now that we're looking at from Blythe, California, who looks to be a pretty hopeful match to this woman.
Wow.
I mean, you know, she has these very unique facial characteristics. You know, you can see both in the missing woman and the unidentified woman and my facial reconstruction. So,
do you do one photo at a time, or do you, like, work in various ones at a time, or just, one at a time?
Just one at a time, or you know, there's sometimes I'll get a few projects going at a time. I've been I've been putting these on my Facebook page and getting a lot of attention on these families of missing persons contact me. I've been getting quite a few, probably more than I can fulfill. But,
I've
been getting requests for people to do age progressions. I've been doing age progressions as well, so. In addition to the unidentified decedent facial reconstructions, I do age progressions as well, and you know, various family members of missing persons have been contacting me and saying, can you do a reconstruction of my sister or my brother or my son or daughter, and so I, you know, if I have the time, I've been trying to fulfill those, but you know, I get quite a few. Yeah, I do have quite a few that I've, or now I'm having people come to me and say, you know, my daughter died at 2 years old, you know, in an auto accident, and I would like to know what she looked like at 18, what she would have looked like at 18.
Oh, my.
You know, those kind of things I'm kind of resistant to doing, because infants are much harder to age progress than say, good, starting from somebody who was maybe 18 years old, their facial structure's already developed with an infant. you know, there's so much, you know, guesswork involved that I try not to. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children does age progressions of missing infants or missing children, so you know, I leave it to them to do those types of reconstructions. I've done I've tried to do it a couple of times, but I generally am resistant to taking on those.
Yeah, that can be tough. I mean, a six-month-old, a one-year-old. I mean, we all look back at our baby pictures and say, man, I don't look anything like that now. I can't imagine trying to extrapolate that out.
Yeah. But like a nose in particular, you can't really guess how somebody's nose is going to develop from when they're 4 years old to when they're, you know, 30 years old. It's mostly guesswork.
No, I mean, I look at my baby pictures. I had, like, really, really blonde hair when I was two or three. Now I have it's not black hair, but dark brown hair. I don't know how anybody could ever figure that out, you know, to do an actual picture of me like 40 years later or something. I'm in my 40s.
Yeah, and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has the equipment, and they have, procedures, and they get photos of relatives, and they, you know, incorporate those into what they do. And, you know, I kind of prefer to leave those types of projects to them because
how do you think that your work goes along with those people who actually do the clay recreations? They have a skull and they put the clay on it. How does your work go in tandem with that?
Well, I've never attempted a reconstruction of using clay. Almost all my work is done on Corel photo paint, using the computer. So, I've seen over the years, some people are better at using clay than others. There are some facial reconstructions are pretty bad and others are, pretty good. So,
it's just another technique. Obviously you would be biased to the drawing that you're doing on a computer, but I'm guessing there is a place for the clay, the people who do the reconstruction in clay as well.
I mean, I did have a drawing class in college, or a couple of drawing classes where we did use clay and did construct faces out of, using clay. And I did a little bit of that, but it's not something I do now. Or, it'd be interesting to attempt it, but you need the equipment.
But there are people out there who do that. You do that using skulls, and I just wondered how one might be different than the other, the pluses and negatives of one over the other. That's all I was asking.
Well, yeah, with a skull, you can do everything in three dimensions, so you can look at it from any angle, and so you have that advantage in that respect. But that's helpful to be able to look at a face from whatever angle you want to, and the clay reconstructions offer that. Obviously, a one-dimensional image doesn't. So, there's an advantage there. But
I suppose you can work though a lot quicker than somebody can with clay. I mean, if you're telling me you can do one of these pictures in a few days, I'm guessing that those people, it takes a little longer than a few days to do what they're doing.
Yeah, I don't know how long it takes them, but you need equipment, and you need to put the put the money into buying, the tools, the carving tools or the sculpting tools that they use, and you have to buy clay, and you have to have an actual physical skull there to build a face onto. So,
It's
I have none of that. So
Well, you've had
to try. Interesting to try at some point, but
And you have you've had some successes, so there's no reason to change at this point. In fact, let's talk about a couple of those. There's this what I'm calling the Spider-Man guy in Brooklyn. Tell the listeners a little bit about that case that you were involved in.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was a case. There was a young man. There was a doorman at the door and tried to stop him, but he ran past the doorman, jumped in the elevator, and went up the elevator. And a few moments later, he had fallen from the balcony of, I think it was about the 12th floor balcony. So he had either jumped or fell off the balcony.
Mm-hmm.
The man was 6'8" and weighed about 500 pounds. So he's a very, very unusually large man.
Yeah.
And so there was a postmortem photo of him on Namus, and he was wearing a Spider-Man watch cap, a watch cap with a Spider-Man logo on it. So, so I had, you know, I'd seen that in Namus, and I thought, okay, let me see if I can create a facial reconstruction of him. This was back when my skills weren't as good as
So this was in the beginning.
They are now.
In the beginning.
Yeah, this was kind of early in my process, when I still hadn't really developed, you know, the tools and techniques that I have now. But I came up with kind of a crude representation of what he looked like. I put a little Brooklyn Bridge in the background just to indicate, okay, this guy was in Brooklyn. And as it turned out, his friends were looking for him. He was from Pennsylvania. He was a man named Ken M.M. Ecker. He had two middle names.
Hmm.
But his name was Ken M.M. Ecker. And his friends were looking for him. He had left home, said he was, you know, didn't know when he was coming back, but I guess he left upset, and his family was worried about him, and his friends were worried about him, and so they started going online and looking for a big man, you know, Googling for a big man with a Spider-Man cap, and they came across the Web Sleuth page and saw my facial reconstruction and said, that's him, that's Ken.
Oh, my.
And, you know, the description left no doubt, because he had certain tattoos and you know, certain jewelry, or, you know, he wore a lip ring and or a lip a stud in his lip, a red lip stud. And
how long did that all the whole process take, from this guy falling from this building to you getting his picture to the friends or family notice?
Maybe a month or two. I believe. The Web Sleuth people were really, you know, kind of interested in the case, just because of the unusual nature of the person,
mm-hmm.
you know, the unusual description of the man himself. But I think the discussion was going on for a couple of months before somebody who knew him actually stumbled across our discussion and
mm-hmm.
you know, knew from the unique size of the man and from his tattoos and everything else that it was obviously Ken.
How close was your artist depiction to pictures you eventually saw of him alive, you know, earlier in his life? They're pretty close.
You know, from the quality of what the stuff that I do now, I probably could have done a better job on the resemblance.
Mm.
You know, there were certain post-mortem effects that I didn't quite, compensate for. So, I mean, using my own standards now, I probably look at that and say, oh, that wasn't that good of a reconstruction, but it was good enough that the persons recognized him and knew who it was.
And that's the most important part, right? That's what we're looking for. We're not looking for getting an A+ on it. We're getting, the goal is to for somebody to recognize the person.
Right. And the cases where I have come up with somebody recognizing a person from my drawing, I think there are three or four instances of that.
Mm-hmm.
None of them are, you know, three of them that I can think of off the top of my head. The quality of the image wasn't, mm-hmm. you know, to my current standards.
So right, but
one other case of a guy who died in a soup kitchen in Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
and it was probably one of the first ones I'd ever done. I think right after that Philadelphia guy, I tried doing a reconstruction of this guy in the soup kitchen just to try it, because I was trying to do more difficult projects to, you know, try to see how well I could straighten out the features of somebody whose facial expression was, you know, badly contorted or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just on a whim did that one to see how well I could do straightening out the facial features. And as it turned out, that was another one that went on the Pennsylvania missing person site, and the family of the man actually went to the site and recognized him from my drawing.
Wow.
So, you know, and again, looking at the quality of the image that I had done, I had never revised it. So, you know, it was the original one that I'd done when I wasn't that good at it, but it's still good enough to result in an identification.
Well, one picture that I did see that was, I think, very much like the young woman who was found was Tammy Jo Alexander, I think a girl that you nicknamed Callie when you were working on it. Tell the listeners about that one. That's one where I think, man, you nailed it. Tell the listeners about that one.
Yeah, I'd revised that image probably 10 or 15 times over the years. I had started with a postmortem photo, and, you know, when I first did it, I was basically just putting open eyes on a lifeless face and putting an outfit on her and you know, maybe straightening out her features a little bit, but I didn't, you know, do all the work I would do now today to, mm-hmm. you know, using pictures of living persons or whatever. Mm-hmm. But over the years, I started developing those skills, and as I said, I revised it probably 10 or 15 times, and, you know, the final version I came up with, by the time she was identified, you know, the final version that I done, I thought came pretty close. I was pretty happy with the resemblance. Her sister, you know, probably isn't, you know, she has said that she didn't think it looked like her sister, but, you know.
Well, I think it does. I think your picture does.
Yeah, I mean, you know, family members are more discerning of,
yeah, sure, sure.
So
right.
That's fine. I don't
right.
take offense.
How did that? How did that case all happen? What happened in that case?
Well, I was I keep a spreadsheet, and the spreadsheet is probably over 17,000 names now. But
wow!
But the spreadsheet takes all the missing persons from all the different sites, and I keep it updated regularly. I add new names, and I remove names of resolved cases. So. So it's a constant process to keep this spreadsheet current and relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, one day back in 2014, September of 2014, I was adding some names to the spreadsheet, and I had run a query on the NamUs system for new cases, and probably came up with maybe five different names. And initially, it was just names on a spreadsheet. There weren't any photos with them when I initially run the query. I just have text. I don't have photos. So, you know, I was putting them on my spreadsheet. I create a link to the NamUs page, and then you know, I pull them up one by one and look at them. And there was one case. Well, there was one case that was from it listed as being from 1977, and the rest were more current. But I looked at this case and I saw this. You know, this girl who was listed as being 13 at the time of her disappearance, we now know that's incorrect. They didn't have correct information on the NamUs page. But I looked at this information and said, okay, Tammy Jo Alexander, I've never heard of her, you know, missing from Florida. And I you know, created a link and pulled up the NamUs page. And as soon as the page came up, I looked at the photo and said, Callie Doe, there's Callie Doe.
And that's a picture you had done before.
Yes, it was, yeah. You know, but my recognition of her was, you know, from having seen that postmortem photo for, you know, over the years.
Yes.
And, you know, it was burned in my memory what I thought this girl looked like, and here she is. She shows up, you know, all this time I had been used to just, you know, the visual image of the lifeless face, but now I have this photo of a girl with a smile on her face, and I'm, you know, I was stunned. I was looking at it, that's Callie Doe. And then I started pulling up the postmortem photos and comparing the teeth and comparing the eyebrows and, you know, looking at the general facial shape and, you know, all the details and thinking to myself, you know, that has to be her. And so I went to the, you know, the Web Sleuth site, and I said, you know, bingo, I think this is Callie, and put side by side on Web Sleuth, and then I immediately put together an email and sent it to the Livingston County Sheriff.
Yeah,
and, you know, put the two photos, the postmortem photo, side by side with the photo of Tommy Joe Alexander, and said, "Hey, I think these are the same person." And
that
know,
had to be a crazy later, feeling, Carl. I'm telling you, you had to been, you know, freaking out. I know. I know. I would have been.
Over the four months period, you know, you're sitting there waiting, and you're thinking, well, you know, maybe it is. Maybe you start you know, doubting yourself, but, you know, because I think her sister at one point said that, you know, she was taller than the listed height of Kelly Doe. So, you know, there was certain things that you're saying to yourself, well, maybe it isn't, maybe I'm wrong, but because I've been wrong before on what I thought were obvious matches.
Yeah.
But in this case, it turned out January of 2015, the Livingston County Sheriff's did a press conference and said, you know, we've identified our Jane Doe from 1979, and her name is Tammy Jo Alexander.
I watched it. I watched that video online. Yeah, I watched it. I watched
it. Then 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm sitting here in Los Angeles, you know, getting woke up out of bed from reporters in New York, you know, wanting an interview, and I'm jumping out of bed saying, you know, wait a second, can you give me a moment to wake up before I do an interview?
Yeah.
It was kind of a hectic situation there for that initial morning. I had all kinds of press people calling me up, and you know, in the 2 years since then, I've been getting all kinds of, you know, interest from various media groups and from CNN and from the, you know, KABC affiliate in Los Angeles did a thing just a couple of weeks ago, and you know, newspapers all over the country. I had a morning drive time radio talk show. A guy named Brother Weez had me on his talk show,
Could you have ever imagined when you started this in 2009 that it would get to this point where you're at sleeping 4 in the morning and there are reporters in New York calling you? They want to talk to you. They want to interview you. They want to hear what you do because of this work that you do. You could have never imagined that.
No, I couldn't have imagined it, and it was an entirely new experience because I'm not particularly, you know, skilled at doing interviews, or, you know, I'm not the smoothest talker in the world, so.
You're doing fine here.
You know, that's not something I've, you know, never had to do was deal with media and deal with interviews and you know, be presentable on a national stage. It's quite overwhelming at first, but, you know, I'm getting used to it as the time goes by. I'm kind of surprised that there's still 2 years later, there's still interest in this case. And you know, there's interest in the aspect that I'm a forensic artist or an amateur forensic artist. And then there's interest in, you know, the Kelly Doe case that ties into that. So I guess that makes for an interesting news story.
What are some of the things you're working on now? I know that in looking through some of these interviews that you've done, tell the listeners a little bit about Walker County Jane Doe.
Well, yeah, that's a case that I'm very interested in now, and I have a Facebook page dedicated to her. Walker County Jane Doe is a teenage girl, probably approximately the same age as Tammy Joe was. This was Halloween night 1980. It was a girl who was hitchhiking, came into a couple of truck stops, asking directions to the men's prison in Huntsville, which is a pretty hardcore prison. There's the death row inmates are housed at that prison, so it's a, you know, high security prison. And this woman was, or this young girl was asking directions to the men's prison, and then the following morning her body was found on a roadside, naked, abused, beaten, sexually violated, and, you know, beaten up horribly, and for 35 years since then, or was it 36 years since then, nobody's been able to figure out who she was. And so this is a very interesting case to me, again, because it involves a young child who you would think would have family members wondering where she is. I created a Facebook page and created a few different images to present what I think she might have looked like in life. And I've been spreading that Facebook page all over Texas, or trying to get people all over Texas to, or out nationwide, as a matter of fact, to spread the Facebook page around in the hopes that somebody might remember who she was.
How long have you been working on that?
Oh, probably that's one of the other cases that I initially became interested in 2009.
So it's been like 8 years. 8 years.
Yeah, so this is the case that, just as with Callie Doe, it was one of the other cases that I was very interested in and have created revisions over the years and improved my facial reconstruction of hers. You know, my initial version of Walker County Jane Doe was a pretty crude, crude attempt, and I've developed that and gotten better and better, and now to the point where I'm pretty happy with the version I have now, that I think I'm pretty confident that it properly resembles what she looked like in life.
Mm-hmm. Do you know anything else about?
Image.
Please tell. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. I have another image that I created from a side view postmortem photo. I created another image of her standing on the roadside with her thumb out, and I had a friend of mine with a 10-year-old niece. I asked her, my friend's niece, to stand on my driveway and wear a sweater and hold her thumb out. So I used the picture of my friend's niece holding her thumb out there to incorporate into the image. And
is that how young you think this Walker County Jane Doe is?
I couldn't use my own hand because I have a male hand. A 10-year-old girl's hand is not that much different from a 15-year-old girl's hand. It's, it's pretty similar. So it's similar enough that nobody would know the difference. So,
well, that certainly sounds like a case that could be solved. I mean, how many young girls can be looking for a prison? I mean, that's one of those cases you'd think 30-some years later somebody would have figured it out.
We did have somebody come forward with a photo of a girl that he had met when he was a brother and sister. There was a brother and sister came forward, and they had said, she reminds me of a girl that we met when we were 10 and 12 years old. The brother and sister were 10 years old and 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And they were staying at a motel with their parents, and for a couple of days they were at this motel in Texas, and they became friends with this girl in a motel, and all they remember was the girl's name was Kathy or Katie or some variation thereof. And the story about Walker County Jane Doe very closely corresponded to the story about Kathy, that as Kathy had explained to them herself. So she said she was a runaway from Corpus Christi, and she had told the brother that she had a friend in prison, and she said the prison was the Sugar Land prison, not the Huntsville prison, but not the Ellis prison, but she said she had a friend who was in prison. So, and she kind of resembles my drawing, not perfectly, but closely enough that, I'm thinking, okay, I can see certain features are very similar, and what isn't similar might be explainable by the, postmortem effects. So, so we've been trying to figure out who this girl Kathy is, and that's, part of the discussion on that Facebook page as well. So one is trying to figure out who Walker County Jane Doe is, and, if it's not Kathy, then who is Kathy?
Yeah. It's like one mystery leads to another mystery that leads to another mystery.
Yeah.
That's how sometimes, there's a listener of mine who likes to talk about how she goes down rabbit holes, and this, that's like what it's like. You go down one rabbit hole, and then suddenly you're going down another one regarding the same case.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
One rabbit hole leads to another.
So. Yes, yes.
And that's the nature of these things.
It is.
You get involved in one mystery, and it leads you to another mystery, so.
Yeah. Well, if people wanted to see your work and try to help you, obviously, with this case we just talked about or anything else that you're working on, where would my listeners be able to find you on the internet if they want to help you out, they want to see your work? Maybe some of them are listening and they have somebody that they're trying to find that, they want to send a picture to you or something. Where can people find you?
My Facebook page is accessible to all. It's my name is Carl Koppelman. That's spelled Koppelman.
Mm-hmm.
First name Carl for the C's, and I'm the only person with that name in the country, so there's no difficulty in finding my Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
Or on the Web Sleuths page, there's the unidentified forum on the Web Sleuths page.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel comfortable giving out your username there?
Yes, I'm Carl K90245.
Okay.
90245 Great. Being zip code in El Segundo, California. So everybody knows who I am. I make it no secret who I, my true identity. It's pretty well known who Carl K90245 is. So.
Right. And do you have a, did you say you have a page for this Walker County Jane Doe as well? Do
you? If you go to Facebook and you look up who was Walker County Jane Doe, that was that's the name of the Facebook page. It's who was Walker County Jane Doe.
Okay, great. So. Anything else, Carl? Anything else? The listeners should know that I need to thank on this interview. I need to thank Kathy Turkanian, who was a guest on a previous episode.
We never got to that discussion, but that's a whole other.
Maybe. I'll have to have you on it. I guess we'll have to have you on again, which I would absolutely love. But it was Kathy Turkanian, who, of course, is still looking for answers regarding the disappearance of her daughter, her biological daughter, from 1989.
And Kathy and I, three times now, have gone to Michigan to try to find answers in that case.
Yeah.
You know, we've found all kinds of interesting stuff, and if the people want to follow that page, there's Find Andrea and Bowman, another Facebook page that we're involved with. So,
but Carl, I appreciate you coming on, kind of at a little bit of short notice, but I think the listeners really enjoyed listening to that. Somebody, just a regular person, getting involved, using their talents and skills, and you've actually solved some mysteries out there. I give you all the credit in the world.
Yeah, and thank you very much. I'm glad to talk to you. And if you want to have another discussion about the Andrea Bowman case,
we can do that somewhere down the road. I'd love to.
Yeah, we can do that some other time.
Sure.
I'd be glad to do it.
Sure.
Okay.
Carl, thank you for being on this episode of Unfound.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
And that was my interview with Carl Koppelman. Such a great guy. What a great personality. I know he made a joke during the interview about not being used to talking to people and doing interviews. And I guess you could say that he was thrust into the spotlight because of his work very quickly, I guess. But I think he's a great interview. I think he did a great job. He's a great speaker. Interesting, friendly, funny. And he's doing great work. And he makes it seem so easy. I know it's not. I have no artistic skills whatsoever when it comes to drawing. So whatever he is doing, it's like rocket science to me. And I know it's difficult, and he's getting results, and he makes it sound so easy. Once again, I know it's not. But I hope listening to him, you understand how he's just a regular guy, just using his talents and skills, and it's turned into something that is really, really good. And I want to assure all of you that you can do the same thing. I'm hoping kind of that maybe you can get involved with this Walker County Jane Doe case. Maybe you can help Carl out on that one, being that he's been working on it for a while. I think some of the listeners of Unfound would like to assist him. Now that you've gotten to know him and you get to hear his passion for solving these cases. And so we've come to the end of the show. Once again, I'd like to thank Kathy Turkanian for telling me about Carl and how he would be a great interview. Kathy, you were exactly right. If you enjoyed this show, I urge you right now to go to iTunes and give Unfound a nice review. Would appreciate it. I'm Ed Densel, and you've been listening to Unfound.